This is Radio Freethinker, episode 97.
And welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And of course, also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So, Ethan,
No one else is here.
I know, we feel so, so lonely. And yet again, I cannot help feel that the quality of the show hasn't gone down that much, considering we're still here, well, he said with a bunch of arrogance.
Yes. Well, we're very good at our job. I mean, let's face it. We're here every week putting out great quality skeptic programming.
Yes, we are. Yeah. But speaking of a lack of quality, something of note for our Kamloops listeners. I was noting in the newsosphere, can I use that word, newsosphere?
You mean,
sure,
yeah,
newsosphere.
Okay.
That there's a somewhat of a growing controversy, although by the time this gets out, it might be a post-controversy, about the Kamloops Blazers, the local WHA team in Kamloops, which apparently has not been doing all that well for a while. And apparently it's local sports editor Greg Drinnan has been letting people know of that in his column in the local paper. Apparently, the new managers who took over, I think it was in 2007, promising to invest a lot of money in the team and to just bring the team around, have not liked the fact that he says that the team kind of sucks, it's in a poor state, and that one member of the team or someone associated with the team said that the team seems almost cursed. And their response to this was to ban him from the games, or ban him at least from talking to any member of the team, which, of course, apparently contravenes the WHA rules, policies and all that. But from what the Blazers are saying is that they just don't want the bad press. It's poor marketing and people will start coming out to the games.
Well, I hope that they don't continue to infringe on his free expression.
Well, you know, the big thing that I'm thinking about in this is, you know, once you kind of let the precedent go that, you know, if someone says something that's true, and apparently they also make like great efforts. He's not a bad guy. He doesn't sit there and say, oh, this hockey player should be shot or sent off to somewhere else, right? Apparently he's quite fair in what he says. He doesn't really pick on anyone. But, I mean, once you sit there and say, well, you know, it may be true, but it doesn't make economic sense, or it may offend someone. Once you start that censorship, even if it's in something like sports, which people say, well, what does that matter to most skeptics, or whatever, it sets a bad precedent that allows it to go on into other areas. So when we sit here and we criticize homeopathy or chiropractic, that may be, you know, uneconomical to the studio, and they may want to censor us, even though what we say is totally true, homeopathy is crap. But for what I understand, you were telling me, Ethan, this is not quite a unique thing to even in Kamloops. You were saying before the show something about Vancouver Canucks having... Oh, no, maybe we shouldn't say that because they might want to take us off the air.
I don't think the Canucks own this station.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure about that.
The power of an independent radio station.
That's right. CITR. That's right, because people support CITR. But you know what? We were talking about getting the truth out there. Sometimes people don't get the truth out there. They put out crap. And, you know, it's sort of some vindication, although not a lot, because of the consequences, that the British Medical Association has officially labeled Andrew Wakefield as a fraud.
So not only was his science proven wrong, not only did the London Medical Journal...
The Lancet.
Lancet retract his article, but now he's not only a bad scientist, but he's a crooked scientist as well. Because what else came out about that?
Well, you see, Wakefield lied about his science. When did he lie? He faked, he forged, he practiced unethical medical standards, and because of him, the link between MMR vaccinations and autism was propagated across the world, and people died, bad science was allowed to continue, and the development of new vaccination technologies, which we are now behind on because of all the bad press they got, is lagging behind. And you could really lay a lot of blame at Andrew Wakefield. And you can also lay a lot of blame at, you know, The Lancet for not doing due diligence on its science. But, you know, we've talked about that before. This is great news, though, in many ways, that they finally have gone beyond retracting the paper. They're actually calling this elaborate fraud via faking data. Now, most skeptics have been saying this from the beginning. The medical profession in the UK is finally catching on. A disciplinary panel in Britain's General Medical Council said last February that Dr. Wakefield had presented his research in a, quote, irresponsible and dishonest way and brought the medical profession into disrepute. Now, of course, this hasn't stopped any of the anti-vaxxers, and, you know, why should it? When you make something into dogma, science doesn't enter into the equation. But it's a nice piece of evidence here that, well, you know, Wakefield is a fraud, he lied, his data is worthless, and the conclusions that he reached, that he propagated, which led to the death of lots of people and the low vaccination rates that are still wreaking havoc, are all based on a bed of lies.
You know, it's funny, too, because I was listening to a recent podcast from NPR, and they had Paul Offit on it, who was talking about his struggle with trying to get the news out there and how you had people who phoned in, and as you say, they just kept shifting the goalposts. You know, he said, well, yes, okay, maybe his study has been knocked, but what about all these other studies to which no one can really point to any accredited studies? I mean, the one thing that made this one so particularly damning was it did have the prestige of The Lancet behind it.
Sure.
But one of the other interesting things that had come up there, and I've got a point to this, so bear with me, that apparently a woman who believed the anti-vaxxer thing didn't get her child vaccinated, went on a holiday, her child got the mumps, right? I think that's one of the ones. That child came back, was sick. She took her child to the doctor, which, of course, what you do. While there, she infected a whole bunch of other kids. Apparently, it was a huge breakup, about 90 people who kind of got infected. A lot of those were below the age of getting vaccinations, which is why they caught it, right? They were below, and you lost the herd mentality. And one of the women of this other children said, I'm not mad at her that she made a decision for her child, but in not getting her child vaccinated and getting my child sick, she made a decision that affected my child, and that made that's what was so wrong about this. And I'm just sitting thinking to those people out there who are lawyers and who are vaccination type people, that bad scientists, anyone can do bad scientists, we're human, mm-hmm. But people who do fraudulent science that can kill people and cause harm to people, that strikes me as something that could be legally actionable.
Oh, yeah. I would not be surprised if Wakefield faced legal ramifications for lying and breaching medical conduct.
Oh, I'm hoping the lawsuits come in, because there'll be criminal or at least academic penalties be paid. But Britain's a little litigious. The United States is really litigious. And do we have the name for... Oh, never mind. But speaking of bizarre studies, we're going to shift from bad study to something that was advertised as sort of a big study, but when we get into details, you see it's not. So apparently there was a study out there that said conservatives have larger fear center and brain. Another headline said political allegiance linked to brain structure, study finds. Apparently there was a study done, and I use study in quotes here, about 90 students at University College in London, conducted by reputable neuroscientist Geraint Rees, that revealed a quote-unquote strong correlation between the thickness in two regions of the brain, the amygdala and the anterior cingulate, and political viewpoints. That self-proclaimed right-wingers have a pronounced amygdala, a bigger part of the brain, that's associated with the fear instinct in humans, and that those people who are more liberal or leftist in their view tend to have a thicker anterior cingula. Now, of course, you go, oh, wow, well, you know, and, you know, there's a few things you'd have to look at this. Well, 90 students, not a huge number of students, right? And, you know, self-proclaimed right-wingers, that's not exactly great. So then I read a little bit more, and I must admit the articles were quite good, just the headlines were horribly misleading. That Rees said that he was very surprised to find this out because the experiment was actually a lighthearted bit they had done for BBC4's Today program for a presenter called Colin Firth. Colin Firth said that he no longer supported Lib Dems leader, Nick Clegg, and that Nick Clegg should have his head examined. He said that, and I quote, I took this to be, he thought that this study was a frivolous exercise, but he wanted to find out what was biologically wrong with people who didn't agree with him. And he thought scientists could shed light on this. So it's funny that this little, you know, humorous story got a big thing, but at least the people involved were it. But Funny thing, when I was doing research for this, I actually discovered there is actually some serious science sort of behind this. Not this study itself, but apparently in the latest edition of the Journal of Politics, there was a study involving over 2,000 subjects on a national longitude study of adolescent health that mapped genetics and social networks onto people. And they found that there's a specific variant of the DRD4 gene that would tend to make people more liberal as adults, but only if they had a large social network when they were adolescents. So apparently, if you have this gene was known about beforehand, and apparently it would make you more of a risk taker, more of a open to novelty sort of thing. And that because if you're open to novelty and you have the right environment, this is the theory behind it, you'll be exposed to more social norms, different kinds of lifestyle, and that in turn will make your viewpoints more broader, more liberal, lowercase l.
So it's sort of like a combination of nature and nurture.
Exactly, because one of the things that they did, which was good, is that they took into consideration things like ethnicity, culture, sex, age, right? Mm-hmm. And they found that it still held true, and that, as you're saying, that there were two critical factors here. One, the genetic predisposition, and two, the environmental conditions. And that, you know, nature-nurture debate doesn't seem to be necessarily a binary one, that it may be an interlinked and commingling one.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of bizarre that you'd find this sort of mixing. But speaking of bizarre...
Well, as everybody knows, our esteemed co-host Rob is off in the UK doing whatever it is he does in the UK, probably something to do with brains. From time to time, he sends us one of his dispatches from a skeptical traveler, and he sends us a very interesting one this week. We'll get to that right after this commercial break, so stay tuned. You really, really don't want to miss this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Dispatches from skeptical traveler.
So, if you'll excuse me, I'm a little out of breath. Let's see what I got here. So, excuse me. I'm Rob, the cognitive psychologist and amateur ice cream taster.
So I went on a whirlwind tour of the West Coast, kind of.
I fell into a puddle as I was running here, and my phone is entirely out of batteries.
And actually, they did an inquiry, the government, I believe.
There's a couple of different theories which then could self-replicate, no intelligent process. There's this sort of... my notes are completely soaked with water.
Tune in next week for another dispatch from a skeptical traveler.
Thanks, Rob, for that enlightening dispatch, which, for those of you who aren't quite in on the gag, that was sort of a mixed mash of past quotes from Rob.
Some of Rob's greatest moments ever on Radio Freethinker.
And having set that high bar, I should point out that in the next episode, on the 25th, we're going to have a guest host.
Guest host, that's right.
Who, if they're listening, should realize how high the bar is for them to cross, that this is the kind of quality you can expect from some of our hosts out there. And such thing. But speaking of setting a high bar.
High bar.
Yes. Study says that near record high sees religion losing influence in America, which is really a roundabout, backwards, sort of left way of not saying something sort of interesting. Now, apparently, in a recent Gallup poll, and I should note that although polls have their place in the world, they're not like a scientific study or anything. They don't have the same kind of rigors. But hell, they're fun anyhow. Anyhow, in this poll, it showed that 70% of respondents believe religion is having less of an influence on American life, while only 25% believe that it was having a greater influence. 2% believed it was about the same, and I'm going to assume the other 3% to make it 100, just were in the don't know, don't care category.
Sure.
Apparently, though, it's not been since the 70s that people have thought that religion's influence has waned, when in 1970 apparently it was at 75%. So we're getting back up there. Conversely, those who think that its influence was increasing peaked in 2001 at 71%. Now, those people out there who think that religious belief and trauma have something to do with each other may note in 2001 in the United States, there was some minor thing that happened that may have influenced people's increased resurgence in belief in religion. What was that plane thing? Yeah. Ethan does a great straight man, except you can't see it on the radio. But anyhow, I looked at these here, right? And I did a little meta-analysis, because, I mean, these all sound really good, but these are the peaks, right? And if you do an average over time, it averages about 35% of people seem to believe that it's increasing, and 56% tend to believe it's decreasing. And that's been pretty much steady, although continually declining, in the sense that religion has had less and less influence since it started in 57. So things are better, but on average, people always seem to think it's having less influence than more influence.
And if they think that it has less influence, they might actually be more motivated to increase its influence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of one of the big rallying cries for the religious right, is that, you know, we're being shut out of politics. We have to get our guys in office so that they can legislate based on divine intervention.
Well, and whenever things are going bad, people always strike at the moral decay of society or whatever.
Sure.
But one of the upticks of this same survey, which actually I do take heart in, is that people's personal belief of how important religion is in their own life is at a near record low. It's at 54%. Apparently, the low, again, is the 70s. 70s were a good year in some ways, not good in other years, ways, where it was at 52%, but it's at 54% now. And that's a drastic drop from what it was in 1957, when this particular numbers were started to be capped, where it was at 75%. And on another positive note, those people who think religion has no place in their life at all was only 5% in 1957 and is up to about 20%. although that, too, has been about steady since the 70s.
Hmm. Well, that's definitely very interesting. I mean, I hope that that 20% is in touch with the free-thinking community that they happen to have.
Well, and also the idea that people who think it's really important is beginning to weaken. So the idea of dogma, I think, is also... I mean, one of the things we've talked about on the show before is that, you know, a lot of people who don't go to traditional churches still aren't quite the atheists, but they're more the spiritualist type. And,
sure.
And that is a, you know, 12-step program to intellectual freedom.
It's kind of the opposite of how it developed. People started out as sort of spiritual, believing in animal spirits, and then they moved on to organized religion, and now they're kind of moving off it again.
Yeah, the downside of the curve.
Yeah.
Although, of course, just to show you that this was an American poll and how the Americans are such biased people, no offense to my American listeners, actually this wasn't so horrible, but perhaps this is because it's been an ongoing study. They also asked a question about, you know, do you go to church or synagogue? And this is also down. It's down to 63%, and it's been going down steadily. It was up to 76% in late 40s. But one of the things I noticed that was sort of this Eurocentric sort of thing was it used the term church or synagogue. So if you went to a mosque or a temple, as in Hindu or Buddhist, you didn't count, right? And so the numbers might be a little dubious. But again, surveys are fun.
Polls are fun. They are fun. But speaking of bad times, not because that's fun or anything, because we tend to do that a lot. You mentioned when times are bad, people turn to religion. Are things bad for, say, credit cards right now?
Well, you know, if God can't bring you out of your depression, shopping sure can. Or at least that's our ethos. Speaking of which, too, Ethan was just raving about something he bought recently, but that'll be a secret. Maybe you'll hear it. Something about Yetis. Actually, this is sort of a segment or a bit that I want to send a shout out to Andrew in Waterloo for sending me a tip up on this growing controversy in certain things. It's about RFID-enabled credit card theft. Now, for those who don't know what RFID, it's radio frequency identification. It's typically a technology that communicates, uses radio waves between a reader and a little tag. If you ever go through one of those security scanners at the store and it goes beep, 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 well, that's a little RF tag that triggered the alarm saying, hey, you bastard, you're trying to steal something, even though you paid for it, and they just forgot to desensitize it. Essentially, RF tags they got two parts. They have a little integrated circuit that has information and sometimes a little program to process the information, and they also have a little antenna that transmits and receives radio frequencies. There are three types of RF tags. And this is just a little background for those people who don't know what the RF stuff is. There are passive RF tags, which essentially are just little strips of metal that when a radio wave goes through them, activate them, and they kind of echo a signal. There are active ones, which apparently have little batteries built into them, which I didn't know that was actually out there. So, and then there are some that are, quote-unquote, battery-assisted passive RF tags, which you're going, what the heck is that? Well, apparently it's called BAP tags, and essentially they're turned off until they get a little signal, and then they turn themselves on and they start broadcasting. So all those people who've watched all those conspiracy theory movies out there, well, there's a lick of truth to some of it, but not a lot of truth. But anyhow, credit card companies have been going on to this more and more recently. In fact, just the other day, I was with someone who made a purchase by swiping their card, not through a machine, but just hovering it over, and it automatically registered a purchase. And of course, some people sit there and say, well, if they're kind of doing this without swiping or getting any numbers, does that mean they're vulnerable? The credit card companies themselves say, oh, you've got nothing to worry about. They use strong encryption, 128-bit, or what they call triple DES, data encryption standards. So even if they do read the data, they won't be able to make heads or tails out of it. That they use a thing called one-time-only codes. So every time you do a purchase, as I said, on the chip itself is data, but there's also like a little program, and there's a little security key that it generates a one-time code on this key. So that's also designed to protect you, right? But of course, as we know, scientists like to test things out, and I guess some people at the University of Massachusetts were a little bored, and they found that they were able to skim That's SKIM, folks, is a new term for y'all to know. They were able to skim cards with an inexpensive scanner. Some of them I saw were available on eBay for as cheap as $8. And out of this, they were able to get the card name, the card number. They were even able to do a little trick, and they didn't tell you how to, obviously, because they want to say, well, you can do it, but we're not going to teach you how to be a criminal, where they could sort of echo the signal to fake a purchase. So it kind of reads the signal, and then it echoes it to another machine to put the purchase through. So there seems to be a few weird things about that. Apparently, one of the people who was involved in doing this little study bit, a system professor, Kevin Fu, found that many of the supposedly encrypted cards weren't encrypted, that actually most of the data on it were plain text. Again, things like the name, the credit card number, expiry dates. Now, you sit there and you say, well, okay, if I looked at the card, most of that information is right there anyhow. But that's the whole point. You'd have to look at the card. One of the things that's sort of a unique risk to these RF cards is the fact that I could be sitting behind you with my little card reader hidden, scanning all your information, and you'd be totally oblivious to the fact that I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's where they say there's a lot of issues with it. Another thing, too, is these cards are sort of designed to work only like an inch or two away from the card reader. But what their research had found is actually it could work up to a couple of feet away. Wow. So you don't even really have to even be close to the person to do this. Now, of course, it's not all horrible news, right? If you sit there and go, oh, God, I'm going to have to throw out all my credit cards, which I don't recommend, but I do recommend you sending them to radiofreethinker@gmail.com. We will dispose of them in a safe and expensive way.
Sure.
Credit card companies, they push the idea that if there are fraudulent purchases made on your card, they will cover it. But if you don't really trust the credit card companies, apparently, again, the same group had found that if you just sort of wrap it in tinfoil or put it in one of those little metal mint tin containers you can have, that usually that's enough to foil it. You can even buy specially nickel-impregnated nylon wallets, about $60, bit of a hit there, but I'm sure they're stylish, that will block all these signals.
What if you use duct tape?
Not enough metal, but there is metal duct tape out there that might actually work. I've seen for metal ducting and all that. It's got the little silver thing. So in theory, that would work. Now, of course, no great technological story can have no conspiracy attached to it. And this one has a conspiracy attached to it. In fact, with one of our favorite TV personalities, the Mythbusters. Apparently, in the 2008 Last Hope Conference, which is kind of a hackers conference, Adam Savage was out there, and apparently he had mentioned that they were going to do a bit about RF tags, you know, Mythbuster segment about the RF tags and reading them. But they were, quote-unquote, scared off of the segment about skimming by the RF industry and the credit card companies, who threatened to withdraw all the advertising from the Discovery channels. And so the Mythbusters just quietly canned the segment. Of course, this made a little bit of a ripple in the media community and the hacker community and all that. And apparently later that year, about a month or so later, Adam, I'm sure without any duress, retracted his statement and said, oh, no, there were, quote unquote, other complications that caused Mythbusters to retract that particular segment. And it was just way too complex to get into all the details.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think I'll give Adam enough credit that if he was really, really scoffed, and it's been a few years, he might have said something by now. But you always wonder where these little nuggets of conspiracy theory comes from. Well, sometimes there are genuine seeds from which these nut trees grow.
I see. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
is Sam from the GO team, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker.
Ethan. Bad. You're supposed to do that quicker and with more thing. Now, you're not going to get any cookies at the end of the show if you don't do this right. The only way we can teach you how to do things right is to punish you so that you learn from your lessons. Have you learned from your lessons?
They never give me cookies. Ever. I never once gotten a cookie from this show. I'm very disappointed.
No.
So, yes, today we're talking about corporal punishment, which, as Don so brilliantly explained, is the use of force to correct behavior. This is actually inspired by many conversations I've had with friends and acquaintances who have some rather interesting ideas about corporal punishment. And I've kind of noticed that it seems like their ideas are informed by evidence, but it's not scientific evidence.
I have to ask you, Ethan. Were these friends inspired to talk about corporal punishment before or after talking with you for a while? Was it the interaction with you that inspired the idea of smacking people to correct them, inspired by you, or was this just a tangential conversation?
I'm sure we were talking about all the bad things we did as a child, and of course I was a good little boy, but I know they were awful little hellions, and I'm sure that at some point, you know, they got a talking to or what have you. So we started talking about corporal punishment, and that's sort of what I realized is that a lot of these people are informed by personal experience and, you know, things that they've heard, but there's not a lot of actual evidence that they've been exposed to about what corporal punishment is, or if it works, or why one would want to use it. So specifically, let's talk about a few different aspects. First, we want to confront the issue of, is corporal punishment the same as child abuse? Second, we want to talk about, is corporal punishment dangerous? And finally, and most importantly, does it work? Now, let's define our terms here. So, child abuse, what is it? Generally defined as the physical, emotional mistreatment of children. According to the CDC in America, child abuse is defined as any act or series of acts of commission or omission by a parent or other caregiver that results in harm, potential for harm, or threat of harm to a child. And it's mainly divided into four categories. There's neglect, there's physical abuse, there is sexual abuse, and there is psychological abuse.
Now, one of the things I noted that when I was doing a bit of my research into this too, and I think it's important for what we talk about a little later, is when we say physical abuse, right, that this is usually aggression directed at a child causing feelings of intimidation, injury, or other physically suffering or bodily harm. And it's very much of a sort of a consequentialist sort of thing. You've actually damaged the child. Whereas psychological abuse tends to be like subjecting or exposing others to behavior that is psychologically harmful. And I noted in a lot of my readings that the psychological seems to be more intentional, whereas you can sort of, and I hate to use this term, accidentally physically abuse a child, where it's almost impossible to accidentally psychologically abuse a child.
Yeah, it's sort of like the difference between, you know, going to smack a kid, but you sort of miss and you hit them and you actually hurt them, versus locking them in a dark closet.
Exactly.
One of them is you intend to harm the child, very much so. So why is child abuse done? And of course, the exact causes are unknown. There's evidence that it's child abuse correlates with parents who are addicts, were abused, are abusive to their spouses, come from a bad socioeconomic group. There's no real cause, because there's no reason to do it. Nobody goes, oh, you know, little Timmy's out of control, I better abuse him some, you know? Like, it's a completely unfortunate and tragic circumstance. Now, corporal punishment is generally defined the deliberate infliction of pain as retribution for an offense, or for the purpose of disciplining or reforming a wrongdoer, or to deter attitudes or behavior deemed unacceptable. When done to children, it is sometimes referred to as corporal punishment in the home versus in the military or in school. And we're really focusing here on the angle about doing it to kids in the home.
I think one of another important delineations we should start right off at the bat, and one of the problems that we may talk about later, is when it comes to the idea of retribution for an offense, right? I'm not quite sure I'm really comfortable with that as far as corporal punishment goes, except, of course, if you reinterpret that, you say, well, you know, actions have consequences. But the whole point of that is to do that last little bit, is to try and deter or to promote acceptable or unacceptable behavior.
Right.
So when you sit there and you say it's retribution, that's the part where I'm starting to say, well, that strikes me as more abusive than correct.
One example that I kind of thought of was suppose you had a boy hit his sister, so his mom gives him a smack in response or something like that. And typically, corporal punishment does not take the form of, quote-unquote, you know, intense physical abuse. It's usually a slap or a spanking. In extreme cases, it's taken the form of hitting somebody with a belt or very extreme cases like a whip, paddles, canes. That was common number of years ago in schools to beat a student with a ruler. And see, corporal punishment is different in another way, is that it does have a specific purpose. It is a form of punishment. The rationale behind it is that it's a quick, cost-effective, and provides immediate results. Now, the question, are they the same thing? Well, there's really actually two answers to this. There's the yes answer and there's the no answer. And the no one goes like this. The intent isn't the same. In one case, you're trying to correct bad behavior. In the other case, you're trying to cause harm. And the end result isn't the same. Corporal punishment doesn't usually result in serious injury, whereas abuse usually does. Now, the yes side will say, well, in both cases, there is an intent to harm. And in the end result, is the same because force has been used when it could have not been used. So, like, why is it even important to specify what we're talking about here? Well, I think it's important because child abuse is illegal. Corporal punishment isn't. In order to have any successful understanding of why or why not corporal punishment should or should not be used, we have to clearly indicate what is and what isn't so that both sides can understand what we're talking about. Because individual experience varies so much on corporal punishment, we have to specify exactly what we're talking about. Consider how for one person, they might be talking about using a belt on a child, or one person might be talking about a spanking, which are very different things.
I think just to one thing, too, to internationalize the context of our thing, it's illegal mostly in North America and in Asia. But when you go to Europe, because I was doing, again, some research, and actually it's banned, even for, you know, home punishment, in places like Eastern, Central, and Northern Europe. And it's also banned in schools and that in the rest of Europe, with the exception of France and Austria. For some reason, smacking your kid around is considered to be appropriate corrective behavior there.
Yeah. I believe most schools in the Western world banned corporal punishment a couple decades ago, I believe. And I know Europe generally kind of banned it, I think, in the 70s and onward. Canada, the U.S., both still allow it, and the U.S. more so, of course.
In fact, actually, Canada has a law that dates back to 1892, but this law was upheld in 2004 that there is a defense for guardian-type people to do corporal punishment as part of a genuine effort to educate the child that poses no reasonable risk of harm and that is done under reasonable circumstances. In fact, Supreme Justice Beverly McLaughlin, you know, basically said that one of the arguments is it's the best interest of the child, and that somehow beating your child isn't in the best interest of justice. And they explicitly ruled that whole argument out. It says that, you know, although we agree that, you know, what's in the best interest of the child is important, it's not fundamental to society or to justice. Although she did rule out that corporal punishment should not be used for children under two or for teenagers. And honestly, I always thought teenagers was the prime target for this sort of thing. But she also came out against using some instruments such as rulers and belts or striking a child on the face or head. That corporal punishment was not appropriate for a teacher. However, And this is all coming from this one particular court case, who I can't remember the name of the court case, but it was a 2004 case, that a teacher can use reasonable force to remove a child from a classroom in order to ensure proper order of that classroom.
Right.
So that all being said, now that we know where we stand in Canada and all that, are you going to smack me around because I said too much?
Well, maybe a bit later. Right. So we've kind of defined exactly what we're talking about here. And typically the reasons why someone might not want to use corporal punishment, I think comes down to maybe two really important single points. One, is it dangerous? And two, does it work? So I sort of looked at both of these questions and tried to find some consensus in the scientific community that we could base this on. And when it comes down to, is corporal punishment dangerous? There's a lot of disagreement and accusations of being either ideologically or just plain biased. And after all, we're trying to determine here if corporal punishment has lasting detrimental impact on a child's development. So what I looked at here is it turns out that there is a fair bit of evidence that it does have lasting damage, but I think you need a caveat with that one. Many sociologists, psychologists claim that there is evidence. The problem is, though, I don't know how you can possibly control for all the factors between childhood and becoming an adult. And then, you know, narrow that down to, oh, it was the corporal punishment, it was the spanking that made this person go bad. And the reason why I would say that, there was a study in 1996 suggesting that children who receive corporal punishment are more likely to be angry as adults, use spanking as a form of discipline, approve of striking a spouse, and experience marital discord. And there's just sort of the tip of the iceberg. They sort of blame everything from depression to alcoholism to becoming an addict. And again, we're talking about an event that happened as a child, perhaps frequently, but let's put that aside for the moment. And then fast forward to the person when they grow up, and they're trying to trace back this one instance to the childhood. I don't know if that's good science.
Well, okay, I'm going to say that it is, but you're creating perhaps a bit of a straw man, maybe not. First of all, you use the term one instance. Usually families that use corporal punishment or schools or what have you don't do it in isolation. It tends to be a, well, I don't want to say habitual, but a standard mode of operation.
Sure.
That, you know, you didn't do your bed, you get a smack. You didn't do the dishes, you get a smack. You ate too much, you get a smack. I mean, and again, not going into the idea of abusiveness here.
Right.
But again, there's a level of consistency as to the response for wrongdoing.
Right.
And in that sense, I think, I mean, most of the research I did didn't say it caused. It just says there are strong correlations because, as we know, it's very difficult to get causal events. Mm-hmm. But you can get quite strong correlations over time.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, we are talking about something that would happen to a child between the ages of 2 and 12 or something. You know, let's assume they're a pretty bad behaving child, probably pretty frequently. I'm not convinced that there's enough evidence to make the claim that correlation in this case does equal causation. I'm open to the idea, though. I mean, I think there's certainly something to it. If you have a child who has low self-esteem, who goes through life thinking, if I don't do things perfectly, I'm going to get into trouble, that probably will have an impact on themselves, you know, when they become adults. I still think it's a bit too broad, though. I'm more concerned about the damage that corporal punishment can cause in the present. And this is sort of going back to my first point of defining what is and what isn't abuse. The problem is that what defines lasting harm, defining lasting harm is a bit difficult. Where I think what we have here is sort of like this continuum. You know, you have abuse, you have punishment. Starts off legal, and then you have it transition, you know, to abuse. When you have a parent, you know, they get frustrated, they get carried away. They start out trying to smack a kid, and then they get carried away, and they end up doing some lasting harm. I think that is more of a danger than sort of the long-term effects.
Well, what do you think of the danger, too? And I know this is getting a little meta-psychological on you, but if you sit there and you have a child, and the child does something wrong, you smack the child to show the child you've done something wrong. The child then goes and plays a game with a friend. The friend does something wrong, and the child said, well, Mom hit me for doing something wrong. I should hit Jimmy for doing something wrong. And you get this perpetuation of a cycle of violence. Again, not high-level violence, but just a constant din of violence.
I think that's an impact as well. I think that's an immediate issue as well, because I think that attitude, that perhaps notion that violence is a way to solve a problem, can be mitigated through continuing education. But you're right. I think it does actually pose an issue. And I think it's a good idea to segue into some of the legal issues as well. As I mentioned, if a parent is accustomed to using corporal punishment, they get frustrated, they get angry, and they step over the line into physical abuse. This relates to why the laws regulating corporal punishment are so strictly defined, but in a way they're very vaguely defined. And Don kind of mentioned already that the laws in Canada, the person administering the punishment must be a parent or legal guardian. They can't be a school teacher or a non-parental relative, like a grandparent, an aunt, uncle, or a babysitter. The force they must use by, quote, way of correction is a sober, reasoned use of force that addresses the actual behaviors of the child.
How do you measure that nuance how do you of force?
I don't know what does that mean. That's really, really vague. The child must be capable of benefiting from the correction, and they say the child has to be not under the age of 2 or not over the age of 12. Again, I don't know why they assume that that's the cutoff point. And punishment involving slaps or blows to the head is considered harmful. Use of any implementation other than a bare hand is illegal. And accordingly to this, bare bottom spanking is also illegal.
Well, it's pedophiles willing to do that.
Sure.
Obviously. But I'm going to give you two questions you can respond to here.
Sure.
The first one is, you mentioned you have some doubts about the long-term effects of corporal punishment as far as doing damage to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that equally true as far as the long-term effects of actually correcting behavior?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the idea is that if you do corporal punishment, you are correcting apparent behavior, and you are somehow making the child a better citizen or a better family member. But that strikes me as more of a long-term sort of thing. And the other aspect, actually, I think I figured out why it's over 2 and under 12. The idea is that under 2, there's too great of a risk of damage, like physical harm to a child. And the idea is once you hit the age of 12 or 13, you now have the intellectual capacity to understand, well, at least psychological corporal punishment, if not a reasoned argument as to why not to do it. Whereas an 8-year-old who's going, I want to go, the only thing they're going to understand, in theory, is a smack. Whereas you could explain it to you blue in the face and they just won't understand. Maybe that's why it's such a weird window of opportunity for parents.
Right. So to summarize, we have sort of the long-term effects, which were, I'm a little skeptical about. Don's a bit more positive about, I guess. And then there's also the sort of legal ramifications that it's pretty easy to cross that line, and who knows what the court's going to rule. Let's go to a commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk about, does corporal punishment even work, period?
The state of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Join the UBC Film Society for their weekly movie screenings in the Subs Norm Theater every Wednesday to Sunday.
This week's screenings are...
Spirited Away, playing at 7 p.m., and The Town, playing at 9:30 p.m., Wednesday the 12th through Sunday the 16th.
Tickets are $2.50 for members and $5 for non-members. For more details and membership information, visit ubcfilmsociety.com. See you at the movies!
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we're talking about corporal punishment, and we're going to discuss whether it actually works. I think this is the most important issue when it comes to something like this, because this is something we can directly measure. So the science on behavior training through violence is pretty well understood. It's not just relating to corporal punishment. It relates to a lot of different things. Everything down from, like, when they work with rats and the little electrodes and all that kind of stuff. They have a pretty good idea of how corporal punishment or changing behavior through punishment works.
Isn't that called conditioning?
Yes, conditioning. Thank you. So, anyway, studies have indicated that corporal punishment on children can increase short-term compliance with parental commands, but not long-term compliances. So it'll work on the immediate situation, but other than that, it's not going to work in the long term.
Isn't there a whole difference between tying the punishment to the crime?
Yes, I'm going to get to that in a moment. So examples of such circumstances that are examples where it does work on the short term is that there are no implements used, so you're not using a belt or a spoon or something. You're just giving them a swift smack or something. And they say, however, the child should be between the ages of 2 and 6, I guess because after 6, they see it as the child gets more reasonable, and you can, in that case, use like a timeout or something, that the punishment be carried out in private, so you don't do it in the middle of the supermarket, and that it should occur less than once per week. Now, what's interesting is comparisons with the same study show that alternative punishments, such as a one-minute timeout, are just as effective. So there's not a need to use physical force. You can just say, okay, go sit in the corner for 10 minutes. Okay. Works just as well. Now, the science seems to be in consensus that corporal punishment is not reliable for punishment. In many cases, it may actually increase negative behavior of the child. And there are a few major problems, not just related to the corporal punishment, but related to any behavior modification. One, the effect is temporary. Two, unless done immediately after the offense, it doesn't work. And this is just the reinforcement comes after the behavior. So, you know, little Johnny steals a cookie. You catch him, you know, 45 minutes later, but by this point the deed is done, and little Johnny's not going to associate the punishment with the deed. He's just going to assume that, oh, I got in trouble for some reason, blah blah blah, right? Now, another issue is that it doesn't pass on any information other than that was wrong. It doesn't, for instance, pass on what I should have done. So this isn't a behavior modifying system all that well. If you break a window and you get punished for it, it means, okay, I got in trouble for breaking the window. But it doesn't tell you, for instance, gee, I shouldn't break a window, but should I break down a door instead?
Right.
It doesn't give you any kind of moral compass for this sort of thing. And of course, as I said, these are problems with punishing in general. And in order for any punishment to work, it has to deal with these points. And there's actually a whole other bunch of issues that we don't really have time to go into, but they exist for people who want to do more research on their own. So the question from a scientific point of view might be, can a nonviolent punishment like a timeout serve just as well, if not better? And if you look at what experts are saying on the matter, it would seem to suggest that. The American Academy of Pediatrics, in an official policy statement, states that corporal punishment is of limited effectiveness and has potentially deleterious side effects. The AAP recommends that parents be encouraged and assisted in development of methods other than spanking for managing undesired behavior. In particular, the AAP believes that any corporal punishment methods other than open hand spanking on the buttocks or extremities are unacceptable and should never be used. The Canadian Pediatric Society, their policy on corporal punishment states, the Psychosocial Pediatrics Committee of the Canadian Pediatric Society has carefully reviewed the available research in the controversial area of disciplinary and spanking. Quote, the research that is available supports the position that spanking and other forms of physical punishment are associated with negative child outcomes. The Canadian Pediatric Society therefore recommends that physicians strongly discourage disciplinary spanking and all other forms of physical punishment. So it would appear that according to the scientific consensus, corporal punishment does not work.
I also find there's an interesting cultural difference there, too, because, I mean, when I was looking up for European pediatric societies and all that, that I couldn't find any support for corporal punishment. In fact, the International Humanist and Ethical Union, which is sort of the, humanist society in Europe, you know, outrightly says we need to stop and all that. Whereas the two examples you gave there from the American Pediatric and Canadian Pediatric say it's wrong, but... Mm-hmm. We culturally accept it, even though scientifically it seems to be a wrong thing to do. And that I find to be somewhat interesting.
Sure.
I can also empathize, I think. The idea of times out and all that are quite good, but if you have a child who's going, on and on, what was one of the things you said, one of the reasons why that in your notes for the show, that corporal punishment was popular because it's quick, and has immediate results. You also said cost-effective, but I don't know if it really costs people much one way or the other. I guess emotionally there's that cost.
Possibly, yeah.
But I mean, there is this whole idea that, you know, if a kid is doing something wrong right now, that a physical response has an immediate, whereas a timeout, one, sometimes you have to be violent in order to get the time. Because, I mean, a kid doesn't want to go into the closet or the corner or wherever you're going to have the timeout,
right,
which involves, you know, a certain amount of violence in and of itself.
Well, I mean, I think you can escape a certain amount of restraining force when raising a small child. They're gonna, you know, pull on your arm. They're going to want to go over there, and you're going to have to say no. You know, it's like a dog, right? Right. You can teach a dog to heal without beating it with a shovel. Likewise, I think with a child, I think part of the key issues they mention is the development of, you know, parenting strategies that don't involve violence. And I think that's very important, because obviously it's not easy to control a child that's, you know, misbehaving. And if you don't have any, you know, prepared plan for such a situation, you might just be tempted to smack them.
I think that goes right in with that whole thing that, you know, when you get pregnant, you seldom get a manual on how to raise children. And there's a number of books out there, but none of them seem to agree. And
that's why people often rely on the advice of their parents and their relatives. And if your parents and relatives used corporal punishment, you're going to be like, well, I turned it okay.
I mean, you perpetuate the cycle of violence or nonviolence, depending on what your family tradition was, irrespective of the evidence. And,
right,
of course, being good skeptics, we like to be evidence-based in everything we do, including raising our children.
Exactly. Well, that was the public service announcement of Radio Free Thinker. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights, as we are running out of time. And I actually have a really cool one. CBC Marketplace on Friday at 8 p.m., they're doing a show about homeopathy, and CFI Vancouver helped them out with a live experiment. So be sure to tune in and check it out. Your local CBC channel, 8 o'clock Friday. It's going to be pretty cool. And then on January the 22nd, we have our monthly cafe inquiry. This one is called How to Pwn a Believer. P-W-N.
Pwn? What's pwn? Is that a call or phone?
It's something like some kind of the thing that all the hip trendy kids are saying these days, you know, like, oh, you got pwned.
Oh, it's like SmackDown for those who
are
like...
Yeah, it's a non-violent smack.
Okay.
Anyway, it's all about how to argue and debate with a believer. And again, that's January 22nd, 11 a.m. at SFU Harbor Center.
And this week, actually, I have a give and receive. Ukrainian Christmas is coming up. And so in the sense of giving, I like to give you knowledge. Knowledge. Apparently, the SFU Philosophy Cafe is holding a discussion about what we know, how we can know it, the nature of existence and human knowledge. That's held January 13th at noon at SFU Harbor Center. Ticks are $5, so $5 to go there. But, you know, that's a few Philosopher's Cafe. It's a pretty reputable thing.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the giving. Now the taking. People may or may not know that we have two leadership campaigns coming up, one for the provincial NDP and one for the provincial Liberal Party. And Radio Free Thinker, along with a few other skeptic atheist groups in the Lower Mainland, are trying to compile a questionnaire to get the views and opinions of the candidates running for that, so we can get an idea of where they stand, so that if we vote for them in the future election or as leader, we know where they stand on skeptical issues. So if you have any questions or any important issues that you want to find out where these leadership candidates stand, please send us an email to radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Is there any other way they can contact us?
They can visit us at our website, www.radiofreethinker.com. They can leave a comment on one of our blogs. They can also send us a tweet on Twitter. We are on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is CITRRFT.
And for those crazy people, you can send us a mental image that I'm sure will transmute through quantum fluctuations of the universe and resonate within our cerebellum.
Sure.
Or not.
Whatever. Well, we're out of time here on the show, so thanks for listening. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying good night.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
So long, folks. I'm going to be around.